Blog Talk Radio.
Delivering you guests from around the world and coast to coast, I'm your host, Bill Maupin. This is Out of Touch Radio. We are alternative radio with a twist on subject matter that really does matter. Be sure to visit our website at www.outoftouchradio.com. And our call-in number is 646-716-4228. People have speculated for centuries about separate planes of existence associated with religion and the afterlife. Today, cutting-edge ideas in cosmology, string theory, and quantum mechanics have developed serious theories of these multiple universes. Our guest today, author of Visions of the Multiverse, popular speaker, teacher, and author, Dr. Stephen Manley, will join us. So, get ready. Welcome to Out of Touch Radio. Thanks for joining us. Today is March the 28th of 2011. Hang on to your hats because you're about to go on a ride into time, space, and the multiverse with our guest, Dr. Stephen Manley. And before we get started, we're going to bring on a regular contributor, Gina Krizel. Hello, Gina.
Good evening there, Bill.
How are you doing today?
Hope you're having a fine one. Hope you're having one, too.
Absolutely. Today? I can't wait for spring to get here. It's, you know, I hear we're supposed to get snow here in Ohio again Wednesday. So hopefully that'll be the final round.
Yeah, that would be nice. It actually could dip into April.
Yes.
Well, tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about astrology. It's a pretty big science, so we'll just skim the surface. But what I wanted to let your listeners know that astrology is actually a mathematical science based on planetary positions at a precise point in time. So some people may just think, you know, it might be some mumbo-jumbo stuff that where does it come from? But it's actually mathematical science. And I just wanted to define that to demystify some of that. Now, things that are particularly important in astrology, some of the highlights, would be the sun sign, which is your birth sign, like if you were a Taurus or a Leo, it's the day you were born. And your rising sign is the time, it has to do with the time you were born. Now, your sun sign is your outward, is your inward personality, excuse me, and your rising sign is your outward personality, the face that you show to the world. Your moon sign is your emotional makeup. Those three things are pretty important to a person's profile. So it's, and if you're looking to compare charts like in a relationship, you can't just really say, oh, I'm not compatible with a certain sign or somebody can't get along with me because I'm this sign. You really need to compare two people's full astrological natal charts to get an idea of compatibility. I think a lot of people make a mistake that they've had a couple of negative relationships with a sign and that they can't ever get along with that sign. So I just wanted to throw a little information your listeners' way that might clear up some things.
Oh, well, thanks, Gina. That's very interesting. I'm a Cancer myself, June the 29th of 61. Now, you know, I've heard that each astrological sign has a rising sign or something?
Well, everyone has a rising sign, and that's the sign that comes up on the horizon at the moment that you're born, at your time of birth. That's how they determine the rising sign. And that is actually your outward personality, the face that you show to the world. your sun sign, like your Cancer, that would be your inward personality. I mean, people might be able to know you're a Cancer by some of your traits or things that you like, but that would be more of your inward makeup.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks, Gina.
Oh, very good. Very good, Bill. Enjoy the evening, and thank you very much.
You do as well. And before you leave, let's give your website.
TarotQueen.net, TarotQueen. And my name, GinaCruzel.com, GinaCruzel.com. And thank you very much, Bill.
All right. Thank you, Gina. And there she is, Gina Cruzel. Well, our guest tonight is Dr. Stephen Manley. He's equipped with a PhD in high energy physics from Columbia University. Professor Stephen Manley moved up the faculty ranks at Yale University before accepting his current position as a professor at the University of Rochester. He's been named the New York State Professor of the Year by the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching and received the 2007 Excellence in Undergraduate Teaching awarded by the American Association of Physics Teachers. As a popular speaker, Manley talks about particle physics, cosmology, and relativity at conferences, alumni symposia, and to high school and middle school students. Let's bring him on, Dr. Stephen Manley. Hello, Stephen.
Hi, Bill. How are you doing this evening?
I am doing wonderful, and yourself?
Good, although I'm ready for spring. Up here in Rochester, it's still a bit cold for me.
Yes, we're experiencing the same thing. As a matter of fact, I was just mentioning that we're expecting some snow Wednesday. I'm just hoping that that'll be the final bout before things start warming up.
Yeah, me too.
Well, I have to say that I really did enjoy Visions of the Multiverse. Prior to reading your book, I was up against some questions regarding multiverses and how religious beliefs could be related. And you know what? To my amazement, the very first chapter concluded that, yes, religion would be discussed. And I just got a question for you here before we get started.
All right.
And it's based on the many religions and the similarities in which there exists a prophet and savior. Could this be an example of multiverse?
Wow. That's when I sort of thought of some religious ideas as a form of a multiverse, it really comes down to how I define the universe. And I define a universe as anything, our universe is anything that we can directly actually know about in terms of, you know, smell it, see it, detect it with some detector or something like that. And when people talk about these different planes of existence in the different religions, basically I think of them as something people can believe in, but I can't reproducibly take some experiment and prove to you, for example, that heaven exists or hell exists or that some yoga person has reached some particular plane of transcendental bliss, or, you know, I can't do that. So in that sense, I define them as being part of a multiverse. I don't know how the different similarities of the universe of the different religions would fit in particular in that picture. Although I would almost, well, I don't know. I certainly am no expert. I can't really even speculate on how that would happen. I mean, we are biological beings, so I would imagine that certain storylines have appeal to all of us.
Sure.
The success of Disney, right, with the Disney movies. I mean, the great ones all have sort of the same storyline. And maybe that accounts for part of it. Maybe it is that there's some association historically between them, right, that we've sort of lost. But I don't know. That's pure speculation on my part, of course.
Sure.
we're going to be talking space, time, dark matter, dark energy, parallel universes. Let's talk about this book. What gave you the idea of putting this book together?
Well, you know, it was sort of funny because I am a physicist, but I do particle physics, which means I basically work at atom smashers, and I'm studying the detailed structure of matter and the nature of forces, which does involve a little bit of quantum mechanics. And by virtue of the way in modern cosmology we believe that the universe used to be very hot and dense, we have to study the nature of forces and particles in order to understand the evolution of the universe. So it's not as if there isn't a tie into these topics, but I didn't really start out thinking that I knew anything much about multiple universes. And in fact, what happened was I was trying to float a different book, which would have had some similarities. It was meant to be a very accessible guide to the exciting convergence of our understanding of the very small in particle physics and the very large in cosmology, which has been a fairly exciting story of discovery in science in the last, 20, 30 years. So that was the story I wanted to write, and I had an agent, Gary Height, who worked with me, and we sort of formulated a proposal, and then I found that the way in which we were floating it to the book companies, they weren't very interested in it because they sort of felt, well, there is a physics for beginners out there. Now, it doesn't really tell that story, so I don't think it's out there at all, but you know, they were basically saying if you go and look on the bookshelves, you would see something that you would think would be that. So they weren't interested. And every time I would have a conversation with my agent, he would say, "Hey, you should write a book about the multiverse." And I kept saying, "Well, what do I know about the multiverse? I mean, a little quantum mechanics, a little cosmology. I mean, surely that book's been written." And so we kept going back and forth. Finally, he said, "You should write a book about the multiverse." And I went, "Fine, I will look into it." And boy, 1 week later, I was totally hooked, because when I started looking into it, I found that there were lots of different multiverse ideas out there, many different ones in cosmology, in fact. One that I sort of knew about coming out of quantum mechanics, but I hadn't really dug into it all that much. And then a number of other ideas that I had never even heard of. And I realized that I was sort of having to sit down and write some notes to try to keep it all straight. And I thought, wow, there is a book here to write that people who are interested in this topic at all might find an accessible guide to the subject, sort of fun. So, and it gives me an excuse to talk about a lot of the exciting background science, and I think the subject itself is just fascinating. I mean, because a lot of these concepts are inferred from our leading major scientific theories. So it's actually pretty exciting. So I tell you, a week after I promised Gary that I would look into it, I was totally hooked. And boy, then I just got stacks and stacks of books and papers and started reading about them. And that's where it came from.
Okay. Well, what is a multiverse?
So, you know, you have to start with what is a universe. And I mentioned that a moment ago a little bit. I think of the universe as anything that we could ever possibly see, feel, smell, etc., or see with a detector. And the ever possibly is important because the universe, the observable universe, that part of the universe where light could have reached us since the start of the universe, we believe is about 13.7 billion light years in radius. So what that means is we believe the universe that we're part of has been around for about 13.7 billion years, and light from a distance that light could go in 13.7 billion years could have reached us. And so that's our observable universe. If there is reality outside of that, we could not have experienced it yet. But this sphere, which basically is our observable universe, should be increasing. Basically, at the radius should be increasing at the speed of light in terms of size. So you might think, well, if we wait forever, the observable universe will encompass everything. But that's not really true, because we live in a universe where the space itself is expanding. And because of that, as you go further and further away, the space is actually receding from us. So there's a limit to how much of the great reality that's out there that we will ever experience. So in that sense, there are regions outside of what we would consider our observable universe. And so if I start from that definition, then anything where there is something outside of whatever we could actually possibly experience would then constitute a multiverse.
Okay. Now, when you spoke of the universe and it's expanding, is it, I've heard that it's expanding fast, rapidly. How is that? How do we know that?
That's a great question. That was a huge surprise. In fact, the theoretical framework that we use for understanding the overall structure in our universes was given to us by Albert Einstein in 1916 with his theory of general relativity. And it turns out that when you basically create a universe in your mathematical model, so what you do is you basically distribute a little bit of matter uniformly around some volume of space in your mathematical model, and you watch it evolve. And when Einstein first did it, he actually saw that the equations predicted the space itself was unstable, that it should expand or contract. And this appalled him, because he sort of thought, well, the universe should be steady. It should always have been like it is. So he actually inserted a term in his equations, which we call the cosmological constant now, which stabilized his model universe and kept it from expanding. Well, a few years later, and then I think it was in the 1930s, Edwin Hubble and a physicist named Slipher, I think was his name. Sorry, I'm ditzing on it. But they were looking at galaxies with their telescope, and they were correlating the distance to each galaxy with how it moved with respect to Earth. And what they found was that galaxies that are further away from us are actually moving away from us faster. That all except the very local galaxies, ones very, very close by, are all actually moving away from us, and that the ones that are moving away, the further away they are, the faster they're moving away. So why does this lead us to the expanding universe? So Einstein, when he heard about this, he was upset, because he realized he had made a blunder in putting this term in his equation, because in fact the space is unstable. It is expanding. So now the question is, how do we get to the expanding universe from this data that Hubble came up with? And there's an analogy that I like to use, which will help it make sense. Imagine that you're making raisin bread, and you have raisin bread dough with raisins scattered throughout uniformly. As that dough rises, raisins that are close to one another will move apart from one another, and raisins that are far from one another will move apart from one another. But because all of the dough is rising, the raisins that start out far apart from one another will actually move further away from each other than the two raisins that start really close together. And the reason is because you've got more dough between them that actually has to expand. And since this is all happening in the same amount of time, you basically can say that the raisins that are farther away have to be moving away from each other faster than the raisins that are close together. So this data that Hubble came up with matches exactly what you would expect if the space in our universe is actually expanding. And this is what events, basically, if you now work backwards, if the universe is now expanding with time and you work backwards, then it must at one point have been contracted into something very hot and dense. And this is the origin of the hot Big Bang model of our universe.
Amazing. Great analogy there, too. I got a question. What shape is space?
Oh, what shape is it? You know, that's an interesting question, too.
Flat, round?
Yeah. Because what happens is in relativity, Einstein pictures space as sort of a fabric, and it's interesting how he comes to that. So how general relativity came about was Einstein recognized that there is an equivalence between gravitation and what we would call an accelerating reference frame. So you know that if you're in a car and you floor it, you get pushed back in your seat. And if you're on an elevator, for example, and the elevator just starts to accelerate upwards, you feel heavier momentarily until the elevator reaches its typical speed. So, and if you're in an aircraft, for example, when it's starting to taxi down the runway, it throws you back in the seat pretty nicely. So what he said was, suppose you were in a closed room with no windows, you actually couldn't tell the difference between standing on Earth in that room or being out in the middle of space on a rocket ship where the rocket ship was accelerating at what a physicist would call 1G. It would basically accelerating enough that you would feel pressed against the floor with the same sort of force that you would be pressed against it on Earth. And he said that, you know, without windows, you would never know the difference. So he calls this the principle of equivalence. And it actually is the core piece that makes his theory of general relativity work. And so in order to sort of figure out how that works, imagine that you are on an accelerating rocket ship and you send a beam of light from one side of a room to the other as the rocket ship is accelerating upward underneath the light. If you followed a pulse of the light as it goes across the room, as it moves a little way across the room, since light actually travels at a finite speed, the rocket ship's room would actually accelerate up around it a little bit. So it would appear to you, if you were in the room and were able to follow the pulse of light as it went across the room, it would appear to you as if the light were following a path that's actually curved downward toward the floor, because basically the floor would be accelerating upward toward the light as the light moves across the room. And so he said this would be what you would see if you were in an accelerated reference frame. And because of the equivalence principle, he said, then maybe that's what you see if you're in a gravitational field. So from this, he basically said that since light travels in a straight line, gravity must bend space, which is just a pretty bizarre idea. But he pursued it, and he developed the mathematics to back this up. And so it turns out that this theory of gravity that works enormously well for us actually interprets gravitation as a curvature of space-time. So the geometry isn't quite what you and I may have learned in high school, this Euclidean geometry with straight lines and flat planes. You can actually create mathematical theories of geometry. This is an area of geometry known as differential geometry, where things are actually curved, and you can have different types of curvature. You can sort of have curvature that's positive so that it looks a bit like a plane would look a little bit more like a surface of a sphere, or it can be negative, where a plane might look a little bit more like the surface of a saddle. And so if you were just creating universes for fun, in principle it could be any of these types of curvature. And in fact, in the early days when Einstein was thinking about the universe and making models of it, he actually thought it had a so-called positive curvature. And this turns out to be important because the future evolution of of the universe actually is tied up with its geometry. If it's a positively curved geometry in the universe and space, then the universe is, it may be expanding now, but it's supposed to slow down and then it will collapse again someday. Whereas if it's negative curvature, in principle, it should accelerate forever. At any rate, so space could be all of these different types of things. It turns out that it's a very special case that we have managed to measure the space in the universe, and it's very close to flat. So there's a story to how we measure it. I don't know if you want to hear that one, but it's interesting. We happen to know that the universe is the space in the universe is actually nearly flat, which is actually a surprise, because that's like saying I threw a dart and I hit a bullseye. I mean, it's just not going to happen very often if you have all these different possibilities.
Right.
So
that
it's probably
sense.
Telling us something about the universe, and it certainly means that whatever cosmology, whatever theory of the universe we come up with, we have to account for that flatness. And people have come up with a scheme for that, actually. The thought is that the universe started out really, really tiny, and that the space could have been arbitrarily curved, but then it underwent a period of what we call inflation, which means it got really big really fast. And if you do that, no matter how the curvature is to begin with, if you blow something up large enough, it becomes flat. So just imagine a beach ball. It looks quite curved to you. But if you blow the beach ball up to be the size of the Earth, it looks perfectly flat to you locally. Right? So that particular strange scheme works. It turns out this idea of inflation solves a lot of other inherent problems with the Big Bang. So this is what we call the concordance model, or the model of cosmology that most scientists sort of think of as our main paradigm right now, where the universe started really small. It went through this period of so-called inflation where it blew up to be really, really big, very fast, much bigger than our observable universe, and then there was a quantum fluctuation in a space in this expanding, inflating matrix, which caused the space to sort of lose the characteristic that was causing it to expand that rapidly, and it slowed down. And when it slowed down, the energy of that expansion was dumped into radiation and particles and basically heat and light and things, if you want to think about it, that basically looked like what we would perceive as the start of our Big Bang. And our observable universe is basically embedded in this inflating matrix of space. And this may sound a little bit weird, but that's basically the paradigm that we have. I haven't been introducing any of the scientific evidence that really supports it, but there are there's pretty hard scientific evidence supporting the basic Big Bang idea. Inflation has some support. A lot of it solves a lot of problems. So people actually, it's got a lot of support in the community. We have some evidence for it scientifically, but people are trying to design experiments to see if, in fact, they think this idea of inflation actually happened. But it does lead to a multiverse, because if you have this inflating matrix, basically you have space that is expanding much faster than the speed of light, and within it, here and there, you will have quantum fluctuations in the characteristics of the space that will cause something sort of similar to the region where our universe is to happen. And people call this the bubble multiverse. You could sort of think of this inflating matrix as being the beer in a glass, and the bubbles being where different little universes, sort of like ours, might be formed. So that's
sure.
One,
well, when
one
we get back, we're going to take a break here, and
okay.
When we get back, we're going to delve into that a little bit more. I'd like to also talk about dark matter, dark energy, and some more about parallel universes. We'll be right back.
Our guest today discussing his latest work, Visions of the Multiverse, Dr. Stephen Manley. In this book, he takes the reader on a tour of different multiple universe realities, explaining in a very accessible and enjoyable way why it is that many physicists are convinced that we are in the midst of a new Copernican revolution. People have speculated for centuries that separate planes of existence associated with religion and the afterlife. The news is that cutting-edge ideas in cosmology, string theory, and the quantum mechanics have motivated the development of serious multiple universe concepts. In fact, to many physicists, the idea of the multiverse is no longer speculative. It is inescapable. It is no longer a question of whether or not we live in a multiverse, but rather how many different types of multiverses exist. A popular speaker, teacher, and author whose lively personal style makes his presentations enjoyable and easily understood. Manley provides a non-technical background for the non-expert reader. He makes liberal use of analogies and examples of everyday experiences, while filtering out some of the irrelevant detail and layers of scientific lingo. Just like his audience, his readers love Manley's non-intimidating conversational tone. You can pick his book up by visiting Amazon.com, or there's a link at our website, www.outoftouchradio.com.
Okay, you're listening to Out of Touch Radio, and our guest today is Dr. Stephen Manley, author of Visions of the Multiverse. Is our universe one of many? Steve, I got a question. Well, not a question. It's a statement. You know, there's just way too many things that has to take place in order for life to exist in our world. Do you agree with that?
Well, I mean, at some level, yeah, there's lots of things that must happen, but I guess I couldn't say there's way too many because apparently it happens.
Right, but it's not by accident. Do you agree?
I don't know. That's now verging on a religious
battle with that one.
Right? I don't have any scientific way of stating it wasn't an accident. All I can say is that that if you tweaked some of the physical constants a bit, you could create a world that is inhospitable for life as we know it, That
sure.
could be.
Okay. Great. Well, let's talk a little bit about dark matter. How does the scientific community explain dark matter?
Wow. Well, nobody really knows yet. That's a lot of people are looking for it. Why we think that there is such a thing as dark matter. So what is it initially? We actually believe that about 80% of the matter that's in the universe we can't even see. It doesn't interact with light, and we don't. We haven't discovered its nature yet. I mean, we don't know exactly what it is. And that's a pretty weird statement to make. So why is it people feel that way? Well, we understand gravity pretty well, and we understand how things like planets orbit stars, and stars can orbit the center of galaxies and things like that. And it turns out that if you look very carefully at the speed with which stars rotate around the center of galaxies, and you can't understand it unless you assume that there's a great deal more gravitation or mass in the galaxy than you can actually see. I mean, because astronomers have studied they understand a lot about what's out there, and they understand how much mass is in your typical star and how much mass is in various clouds of gas that are glowing out in space. So it's actually a surprising statement when they look at how the stars orbit in galaxies, and they compare the amount of mass it would take in order for stars to orbit that way, and they compare it to how much they can actually account for and see, they find that we can only see about 20% of the mass necessary. And
okay, so
we call that dark matter because we can't see it.
Okay, so here's a spin on things. If we use the Schrodinger's cat theory, where we don't know if the cat is dead or alive. First of all, can we talk about Schrodinger's cat? Can you explain that one? And then I want to go into the dark matter theory.
Okay. Well, that's a. So the idea is in quantum mechanics, you view particles as waves, not as. You're not modeling them as like little solid BBs. You have to consider them as waves, and this has big implications for how we deal with things. So it turns out that in quantum mechanics, you can't calculate exact things. All you can calculate is the probability that certain things will happen. So if you have a radioactive nucleus that might decay, I can't actually predict for you exactly when it will decay. I can only predict for you the probability that it will decay within a certain amount of time or something like that. So this is a fundamental limitation to quantum mechanics that people have struggled with. And it works out really well. And it's not that it's useless. I mean, probabilities are very useful information to have. I mean, would you ever get on an airplane if there wasn't a low probability that it was going to crash, right? I mean,
we
all believe in probabilities. So quantum mechanics turns out to be extraordinarily useful, but it can't give you something exact. So what that means is that if you have a quantum mechanical process and you're trying to model it mathematically, the system that you have has to preserve the possibility that anything that could happen in principle to the system might happen up until the very moment that you make an observation. And at the moment you make an observation, then you know what happened. So the mathematics that you're using to describe this probability distribution has to change, and it basically changes instantaneously once you've made this measurement. So that's sort of the idea that, that when there's a quantum uncertainty, that uncertainty gets preserved. So Schrodinger's cat was an idea put forth, a little thought example that was put forth to show how strange this idea is when it meets the real world. So the Schrodinger cat example is, you take a cat and you put it in a box, and you put it in a box with one radioactive nucleus of an atom that has a probability of decaying that, say, one half in the next hour. So if you wait an hour, there's a 50-50 chance that that thing has decayed. And then you have a little detector in there that will detect if the radioactive atom decays, and if it does, it drops a hammer on a vial of poison and kills the cat. So you put all of this in the box, and you close the box, and then the question is, what's the state of the cat? And in quantum mechanics, once you close the box, what do you actually know? All you know is there's a system in there that has this probability of decaying. And it may have decayed, and if it did, the cat's dead, or it may not have decayed, and if it didn't, the cat's alive. And you don't know what happened. So if you're trying to model this in quantum mechanics, you would model the cat as being half dead and half alive. And that would be the state. That would be, if you were trying to model it mathematically, that would be what you would have to carry on. And you would have that strange state up until you actually open the box and make an observation, where then the state of the cat would, we say, collapse into either a dead or a live cat. Now, the funny thing is, this collapse is very bothersome to physicists because it has to happen instantaneously, and that bothers people. So there are two ways around it. One is to sort of ignore that strangeness and say, well, you can never see the cat when the box is closed, so we're not going to really worry about what we call it the wave function, which is mathematics that describes the state of the cat. We're not going to worry about it because really all we can do is know what we observe. So we're going to say that, yeah, there's sort of this instantaneous collapse, but since we really can't ever have direct knowledge of this wave function before the collapse, we're just not going to let it bother us. And that's called the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. There's another way of looking at it that was floated by a guy named Hugh Everett in the 1950s for his PhD thesis. And he says, well, the mathematics that sort of describes everything is sort of, we'll think of a universal wave function, so something much bigger than just that little cat. And what we'll say is that when we have the cat in that state of uncertainty, we've closed the box with the nucleus in there, and the cat in the mathematics has to be either dead or alive, he allows this mathematical wave function that encompasses basically our universe to sort of allow two different threads of reality to happen and evolve very smoothly. And in one of those threads of reality, the cat is alive, and in the other thread of reality, the cat is dead. And these two threads of reality are, they may happen in the same space, and they may happen in the same time, but they are separated by dimensions that are used in the quantum mechanical calculations. So the alive thread and the dead thread can't actually see each other. And so this is the idea of parallel universes that comes out of quantum mechanics, and it's a pretty strange idea.
Sure, and you were, before we went to break, you were going to explain about the bubbles. Can we go back to that, please?
Yeah, so this idea is that we have hard scientific evidence for the fact that the universe is expanding, and very good scientific evidence that at one point it was really hot and dense, and this is why people believe in the Big Bang scientifically. We actually see light from the early stages of the Big Bang that we coming to us from all around, which we call the cosmic microwave background, which is observed to have exactly the form that people would believe in. Also, the distribution of nuclei in intergalactic space, the ratio of hydrogen to lithium and stuff like that, for example, is exactly what would be predicted if you basically put a very hot, dense pile of energy in a pot and cooked it and let it cool and expand, that basically it would condense out into a certain distribution of nuclei that's pretty well understood and called Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So there's some pretty good reasons people believe in the Big Bang. It turns out, though, that the Big Bang has some real fundamental problems, one of which is the universe is actually flat, and there's nothing inherent in the Big Bang model that would say that the space in the universe is flat. So there are other problems too, but I think I won't take the time to explain them. But the idea is that to get around these problems, we have this idea that what became our universe started out very, very small, and whatever it was began to expand extraordinarily fast in this idea of inflation. And so you imagine that the greater reality, of which our universe is a little piece of it, is actually space imbued with a characteristic that it is expanding really fast. And there are ways to make that happen theoretically, that you can postulate the existence of what theorists would call an inflaton field, so that's basically a characteristic that could actually change with time a little bit. And so you can have this idea, this characteristic in the space that can actually fluctuate around a little bit. And it turns out that if it fluctuates certain ways, the space that where that fluctuation happens might stop expanding so fast. So in this picture, we have this big inflating matrix, and then here and there, you can have the space slowed inflation stop. And when that happens, the energy that's in that bit of inflating matrix basically gets dumped into hot particles and light and stuff, so it would look a lot like the start of our Big Bang. So in this funny idea, you would have this inflating matrix with basically bubble universes starting off in different places. And the other thing that comes out of this is, even within a bubble where you might have formed a universe, the bubble itself might be vastly larger than our observable universe. So we could have, for example, region of the greater reality that is much larger than our universe, but that is much larger than our observable universe, but yet very similar to our observable universe. And then outside of that, so that might be our bubble, and then outside of that you might have this inflating matrix, and way beyond within that matrix you might have other bubble universes that happen. So these are two of the multiverses that have that are basically inferred from our modern scientific paradigm, because this crazy idea of inflation is actually supported to some extent. We can look at details in the structure or the patterns of different frequencies of light or colors of light coming in the cosmic microwave background, which is light coming from the early, early part of the universe. And from that, the patterns are consistent with inflation having actually happened at the early stage of our universe. To my knowledge, we don't yet have smoking gun conclusive evidence that inflation happened, but the indication is that it's supported by science. So, and if you had inflation, if it's indeed something like that actually happened, then it's really hard to avoid these different types of multiverses. In fact, they could all happen at once. we could live in a bubble multiverse, and then within our bubble, it could be much larger than our observable universe. So you can argue that that's a multiverse because you have regions of space that are further than we can ever experience. And then all of this could have quantum mechanics happening inside it, which could have these parallel streams of realities. So there could be lots of different multiverses happening.
So in all of those, there's got to be a parent universe, right, that creates these, baby universes? Am I right?
Yeah, I mean, I, that's a good question, and I'm not really sure I'm the right person to answer that particular question. I mean, that is a question people have investigated, and I'm a little bit on thin ice because I have read where you can cobble together that they call it eternal inflation. I mean, I think you can cobble together a way to basically have this process go on forever, and it's just hard to get your head around that. You also run into some weirdness when you start thinking about this stuff, which is the flow of time, right? I mean, time for us, I guess we can sort of think of in some sort of linear fashion all the way to the start of our particular bubble or our particular universe, our Big Bang. But what do you do about time before that? And So you have to have a weird concept of actually stepping outside of our universe and defining some sort of time that way. And, of course, we know that time and space are much more complicated than we typically grow up thinking of them as. And that is not, I mean, that's something that comes out of relativity. We know, for example, that that space and time get a little bit mixed up when you're relating an observation from one reference frame to another. So, for example, from our point of view to the point of view of somebody who's zipping by in a very fast spacecraft, it turns out that in the transformations that translate what you might observe in one reference frame to the other, space and time actually get mixed up mathematically. So they're not independent in the way that we typically grow up thinking of them as being.
Sure. Well, before we end here, are you familiar with this space probe or satellite that's going up in space this year, LISA? Are you familiar with that?
I am a bit familiar with LISA, but I had no idea it was going up anytime soon, actually.
I thought I heard that it was going up in 2011.
Really? Wow. No, I didn't think it was ready for that.
Okay. But I could be wrong. I'm just going by what I thought I had heard. And I believe it was Michio Kaku that had mentioned it a couple of years ago, that it would be taken off in 2011.
Well,
okay. Well, anyway, let's talk about what it's going to do.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a probe that's looking for gravitational waves, actually. So we've talked a good bit about general relativity earlier and the fact that general relativity interprets gravitation as sort of a distortion of space, and because space and time are all mixed up, we actually say distortion of space-time. Strong gravitational fields actually can affect the rate at which a clock runs. So it, as strange as that seems, space and time are all mixed up. So at any rate, if you could imagine that having a large mass actually causes a distortion in space, what would happen if you wiggled that mass around? That distortion would have to wiggle, right? And it would be like creating a distortion that sort of wiggles outward like a wave. I mean, and so if you threw a rock in a pond, you would, the disturbance sort of moves out in the fabric of the water, if you will. And so if you have a large mass, Einstein's general theory of relativity basically says that you will cause a disturbance in the fabric of space-time that will propagate outward at the speed of light. And that is something which we call gravitational waves. And it's a solid prediction of general relativity. We have not yet observed it. And the reason is, just like on a pond, when you throw a big rock into a pond, right where the rock hits the water, the height of the wave is very big. Or we would say the amplitude of the wave or the intensity of the wave would be quite big. And as the wave propagates outward, the height of the wave becomes smaller and smaller until, you know, it's far enough away you can't see it. So the same thing happens with astrophysical processes. If I wiggle a big, great big mass out in the middle of our galaxy somewhere, it will cause gravitational waves that will propagate outward, but it's very, very far away. So the typical disturbance in space-time that we would see here on Earth or around Earth would be extremely tiny. I mean, something smaller than, say, an atomic nucleus. So, I mean, or a proton. I mean, really, really tiny fluctuation and or change in the space. It might be repetitive with a certain pattern, and so people are trying to build detectors that could see it. There's an experiment called LIGO, which has is made of laser beams that basically travel about 4 kilometers back and forth many times, and it turns out that this device might be sensitive. I mean, it was designed to be eventually sensitive to gravitational waves. LISA is an experiment where you put up several different satellites, and they're very, very far apart, and basically they're very sensitive to the passage of gravitational waves, which you can think of it would basically change the distance between the satellites very slightly. And if you think of a train of waves like you would get if you put your hand on a pond and sort of just moved it up and down in a regular frequency, you would sort of get this train of waves moving out. And so some signals, gravitational waves, would look like that. And so the idea would be basically to look for a signal where these two satellites are moving closer and moving farther apart.
Well, thank you. And I want to thank you for joining us. And before you go, what do you have going on this year for 2011?
Well, I'm in the midst of doing a couple of experiments where we're trying to study the fundamental nature of neutrinos, which are a type of subatomic particle that were discovered in the last century. And we're hoping that with a lot of hard work, and I'm by no means by myself. I'm working on an experiment called MINERVA at Fermi National Lab near Chicago, and another one called T2K at JPARC Lab, which is north of Tokyo in Japan. And I have lots of distinguished collaborators. And so, but the idea is maybe that neutrinos have a difference between matter and antimatter, that antineutrinos and neutrinos are slightly different. And if that's true, we may be able to understand why the universe is matter and not antimatter. So that's the big puzzle we're sort of trying to work on.
Okay. Well, Stephen, I want to thank you again for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us on Out of Touch Radio. And we really would like to have you come back soon.
Okay, Bill, I appreciate you having me on.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
There he is. Stephen Manley. Be sure to pick up his book, Visions of the Multiverse, to eat free. And pick the book up at Amazon.com. There's a link at Blog Talk Radio on my show page. I want to thank you for joining us, and until next time, peace.
around.